The rigors of the vacuum provide a constant challenge. You're listening to Western Worlds. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds. My name is John Kissy, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Centre for Planetary Science and Exploration here at Western University in London, Canada. The environment of space is a uniquely harsh and unforgiving one. The task of building machines that can survive and operate in the vacuum of space is challenging, involving the integrations of many different systems and disciplines. One system fundamental to all designs is the thermal system. This week we talked to Sylvain Vey, thermal engineer of the European Space Agency, about his career in space engineering and the requirements for engineering thermal systems for so many different spacecraft. Let's go to the interview. Okay, first of all, thanks very much for speaking to us, Sylvain. Maybe you could start by telling us what your current position is.
Okay, so my current position is thermal engineer at the European Space Agency. And I work for two specific projects, which are the METOP program, METOP First Generation and METOP Second Generation.
Excellent. Let's start a little bit, sort of at the beginning. Maybe you can tell us a bit about your background, where you're from, and maybe tell us a little bit about why you chose to get into thermal engineering.
I actually originate from Lyon in France. I studied there for 2 years physics, like theoretical physics, basically. And then I decided to move into more practical studies for a more practical job later on. So then I moved into some master's degree of engineering, mechanical engineering, in Lyon again, for which I did 3 years of studies. I actually graduated as a mechanical engineer in 2003. And then following this degree, I actually went to Marseille in the south of France to do another master's degree about air and space technology. And right from the beginning, I have to admit that I was always a bit interesting with space and what happens in space. So when I was doing the theoretical physics at the very beginning of my studies, I was interested to try to work for astronomy, in the astronomic field, let's say. Investigating the path that were possible to go into that direction and to work into space, I decided that I was more fitted to work in engineering and then space engineering, basically. So all the courses, the educational courses, is really focused to try to get to work into the space engineering field. In my last master's degree, when I was in the air and space technology degree, I actually had to do a traineeship of 6 months, which I managed to get at the European Space Agency in the thermal engineering section there. So this is how I started to put a foot first into the European Space Agency. And I started to work there as a thermal engineer, so of course a trainee first, doing some cryocooler cryogenic modeling, mathematical modeling. So this is how I started to, and then I quite liked it, so I decided to pursue a career into this thermal engineering field, and here I am, still there after 10 years now even.
Maybe you can discuss a little bit about after you graduated, when you started.
So after my traineeship at the European Space Agency, I got awarded a one-year contract there to work experienced thermal engineer, at the beginning at least. So this is where I started to work on designing some thermal control system for on-ground experiments at the European Space Agency. On-ground experiment, they were going to Concordia in Antarctica. And then after this 1 year period, I made a little bit of a turn career-wise by leaving the agency. The European Space Agency, to go into the industrial side of the job, which is then Airbus Defence and Space. This is the way it is known now in England, Stevenage. And there I work for 1.5 years Also as thermal engineer, designing mechanisms, basically antenna deployment and rotating mechanism, pointing mechanisms. So it's pretty interesting bits of satellite. Mm-hmm. It's a bit small. We don't know it too much, but it's quite essential to get the performances, especially for telecom satellites. So I stayed there for 1 year and a half. And then I actually get a bit of a... there's a homesickness from the Netherlands, even though I'm French. And I decided to leave England and go back to Holland at the European Space Agency here in Noordwijk in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. And since then I started working as a thermal engineer, taking care mainly of the Earth observation satellites. Well, some of them, not all of them, obviously. Mm-hmm. And this is how it happened.
What is it about thermal engineering that you enjoy?
Thermal engineering is always one of the last thing that people will think about on the satellite, because it's first of all, the thermal engineering system is rather cheap. You know, I was comparing some data the other day about the specific project where the project overall is 600 million euros, while the design and thermal hardware procurement of the thermal system is only 2.5 million. So the proportion of it is very, 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 very small. So this is why people tend to think that it will be the last thing to be considered. But somehow nothing works if it's not at the right temperature. Mm-hmm. So it has to, the thermal engineering and thermal control system has to interface with basically all the other subsystem. It has to interface with electricity because we need power to try to warm up the satellite. Mm-hmm. So we need to limit our energy. We need to make sure that the structure integrity is guaranteed by the temperatures as well, so that there is not too much gradients. We need to make sure that the electronic components, the computers, are working as well at the right temperature. So in the end, you are just interfacing with all the subsystem in order to make them work. So I would say that the thermal control system, the thermal engineer, should be very discreet in a project. Because people don't want to hear any problem on thermal. So the more invisible you are, the better you are as a thermal engineer, is because you are like already anticipating all the problems that happens, and it doesn't come back to the other subsystem. Yeah. So this is the way it happens. So I like this kind of interactions with all our subsystems. It's not so specific like, I don't know, solar arrays, where people are really focused on one particular
thing. You need to know a bit about all the other systems, in that you need to understand how thermal differences can affect those systems. So do you find that you're also looking into the way other systems work? Have you got a general knowledge of satellite systems in that way?
Yeah, I think thermal engineers, generally speaking, are while they grew a little bit more into their job, and if they... Of course, there are some thermal engineers which stay very focused on what they want to do and do some technology development. But if you're starting to work on a project, then you're interfacing so much with so different systems that you need to know how they do work and how they affect you and how you will affect them as well. So obviously, for example, the attitude and orbit control of a satellite, what we call an AOCS system, is fundamentally impacting the way the satellite will behave thermally speaking. So you have to understand all the orbit, all the attitude, all the movement that the satellite will do, and why they will do that, and how you could prevent it. So yes, you really need to get interested in it to have a full picture of your thermal design, because you know it can go to the little bits of the thermistor that is taking up the temperature and how it's actually built. Because if it's not built the right way that you want, there are going to be a bias in the measurements. Mm-hmm. And then you don't have the right information and you cannot control anything anymore. So, but thermal engineers, I think, in general, could be very good system engineers in the future because of this right wide approach and the multidisciplinary approach, sorry. Mm-hmm.
When you come up against issues in design, is there flexibility in the way that you can manipulate your thermal design to resolve certain issues, or is every project requiring a different perspective?
Yeah, I think... when problems arise on a thermal point of view, what you have to know is that thermal engineers work with very limited set of different pieces of hardware. Okay, basically, you have the temperature sensors, you have four to five different ones. You have heaters will warm up your items. There is like 2 to 3 different ones type. Of course, you can adapt the resistance and whatever the power that they give. But and then there is like painting to change the thermo-optical properties of the substrate. And then there is blankets, insulation. So these are the only 4 things that we can work on to try to solve problems. At the same time, each satellite is completely different. First of all, at least at the European Space Agency, because of course they are always unique satellites, and these are the programs are always different from each other. So basically, we have only this limited set of hardware to implement into the system, and with this, we have to make a combination to be able to solve the specific problem of the spacecraft itself. Okay, so there is no huge revolutionary technology implementation to bring to a satellite. There is more trying to accommodate, try to understand the needs of the satellite, and try to accommodate the hardware that you have available for you into it to be able to make it work. So this is the way the troubleshooting works in thermal engineering. But for example, lately one of the most common problem is basically the available power in a satellite. Okay, mm-hmm. And then at the very beginning, when you launch your satellite, your solar array is not deployed, so you don't generate any electricity, right? So basically, you get only the batteries giving you power. So even though most of the payloads and most of the electronic equipments are actually turned off and do not draw electricity from the battery, you still need to keep it at a certain level of temperature, because otherwise it's gonna die, basically, the electronics. So you need to draw a lot of electricity from there. And then all this phase is greatly influenced by the size of your battery, by the way your thermal design is being optimized to limit the energy that you need, and also by the attitude of your satellite. Because, of course, if one face is facing space and the other face is facing sun, there will be a difference. And then we need to be smart into what we do here. So these are all these... when a thermal problem arrives, we have to anyway talk to our subsystem, but we also have to find the solutions ourselves into the accommodation of these 5 different solutions, basically.
Do you find that the space environment can provide you difficult challenges in terms of maintaining a constant temperature?
I think one of the good thing about the space environment on a thermal point of view is that it's very well characterized. We really know what happens. Unlike on the ground, when you start to have air and convection, it starts to be a little bit, let's say, more tricky,
yeah,
to actually determine what is going to be your heat exchanges with the environment. In space, it's easy. You have radiation to space. You have the conduction between bits, and then you have all this, what the sun is giving you in terms of energy, all right? So this we know. So this being said, we know that, as I said before, when you are illuminated on one side by the sun and then on the other side you see deep space, there's going to be a big gradient. So I think on a massive satellite of, I don't know, let's say 4 tons, 5 meters high, trying to achieve an homogeneous temperature of, let's say, 20 degrees, for example, is not realistic in terms of power consumption and needs. You know, it's going to be way too much. And on top of that, there is no real need for it. You know, if you have an onboard computer that works at minus 10 degrees, that has been qualified to be working at minus 10 degrees, why would you bring it at 20? You can bring it at minus 5 or 0 degrees and it will still work, you know, because you have tested it, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So there is no real need to be at an homogeneous temperature. However, this is for the platform, let's say, you know, for the avionics, but We have to remember that satellites are carrying payloads, and most of the time payloads are involving optics, telescopes, whatsoever, for which the alignment of the optical lenses and the detectors is crucial, mm-hmm. to have a good accuracy of what measurements we are doing. And then, since most of the items are actually integrated and manufactured on ground at 20 degrees, let's say, it means that it's all aligned base at 20 degrees.
Mm.
So if you start to go at 10 degrees, you will have a deformation, thermoelastic deformation, right?
Of course, yeah.
So in these particular cases, you would be really willing to leave it at 20 degrees all the time. But, okay, you know, thing is that you need an artificial source, of heat, let's say, and this source of heat is only localized anyway. So it means that on a long tube, long telescope, for example, a long baffle for the telescope, right? If you warm up the top part, but not the bottom part, then you will start to have gradients in your telescope baffle, and then it will start to bend. And then you lose also your accuracy. So it's sort of fine balance between what are the actual pointing needs, I would say it like this, on ground for the instrument, and what can be done. Because, of course, when you start to do something on an item, you actually change its behavior, and then it tends to react in not always the expected way.
Very interesting stuff, and real eye-opener for people to get an understanding of a position like yours, because it's not something that a lot of people would think about. You know, they might not think about the thermal engineer. I mean, that expertise is something that's really important. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about how you found the differences between the environments growing up in France, then moving to an international environment.
Well, I mean, the biggest challenges. Well, first of all, I actually had the first experience abroad in Toronto, in Canada, for my last year of master's degree in engineering. So this is where I had the first experience on the foreign environment, let's say. I don't know. You know, it has been like 13 years that I left France. So you know, I tend to be really accustomed to the fact that I'm not in France anymore. But at the time, it all came to the fact that, okay, it was France I was studying here. I was a bit fed up of my own country and the way things were going, so I tried to get something new. So I went to Canada. I really liked it for 1 year over there. It's a bit too far from Europe, I have to admit, so that's why I did not pursue the experience there. Then I came back into the Netherlands, and in the Netherlands, somehow, I felt at home almost instantaneously, you know, very weird, even though I still, after 10 years, do not speak the language.
Still let me speak Dutch.
Yeah, I still do not speak Dutch, but people are kind enough and educated enough to speak English to me, so they are very nice. I really felt at home. People are welcoming, they are nice, they are easygoing, you know. When the Netherlands, it's quite of a northern country where it's continuously raining and having grey skies. But as soon as the sun goes out, this country springs to life. So in the Netherlands, I really, really felt at home right away. But also at the European Space Agency, one of the beauty of it is that it's a total multicultural environment, because, as its name says, there is all the European citizenship represented there. So all the people are expatriates, in fact. So all the people are seeking for new acquaintances and contacts and connections. So it's much easier to get into life. So
you're listening to Western Worlds. Let's go to the discussion. Well, that was an interesting conversation with Sylvain. What do you think about our thermal engineer friend?
It was okay. It was, first of all, it was, you know, strange. I had not thought about like thermal engineer as like an engineer. Well, like, I mean, you know, like someone works on heat shield and like thinks about that, but like, you know, you don't
an actual specific role, right?
Exactly.
It's done by a single person.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that was something new, which, even though, like, I mean, in this field, like, I'd not heard about it. So yeah, it's interesting, you know, how physics and like engineering and all those things come into play together. And, you know, space is literally amongst all possible, you know, sciences, engineering, I guess, social sciences, everything mixed together.
Yeah.
Everything is required when you are talking about space. It's like Earth, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, I was very interested when he started talking a little bit about the different considerations he has to make when he's designing a system, and how the temperature of the components, like keeping that at a uniform level, is really important, no matter what spacecraft you're
working on.
From. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm like, it's really interesting to see, like, how, I mean, I'm thinking about like a little bit in future, but like if you're looking to go on different planets, how like their atmosphere and their gravity and things like that would need to be considered when you're building those things? Like, for example, if you're trying to land on Venus, it's really hot there already. Exactly. So you got to think about material that will probably not melt with the heat of the surroundings as well as the internal heat generated due to the system.
And also the drastic change that you get. So the change you get, say, not necessarily just in when you're in the atmosphere of a planet, but when you move from, say, a place that's shadowed from the sun to a place that's in sunlight, if you're any distance up to sort of Earth or Mars, then that's just instantaneously a massive temperature change.
Yeah. I mean, especially thinking about Mercury,
Becky Colombo that's going to Mercury, exactly right.
Yeah. And even like just the discovery of ice, people never thought, you would find that on Mercury because it's so hot close to the sun. But there are still cold places on that place. If you're sending something to land over there, you would have to think about where you're going to land, what kind of material you're going to need, and like the physics and the engineering of that. So it's something that no one would think about. You need a system that, even just making something that enters back to the Earth's atmosphere after going to ISS, even though ISS isn't that far, you still need something that's engineered for that special task.
And having the components organized in such a fashion as to be most efficient. And of course, we're still not really in a situation where we're creating satellites on an assembly line. So every satellite that we make is kind of a unique device single way. So for every single project, that design that has to change, and that configuration therefore might change, and the materials used might change, and so that's a difficult thing to really to try and spin all those plays together.
Yeah, one of the other examples that I can really think of where I'm assuming a thermal engineer would be required was something when you're talking about Juno. Just the radiation from, like, forget the sun. This far away from the sun, you don't have to worry about it. But then you have the radiation from Jupiter that you have to worry about. So then you want to make sure your instruments are not fried.
Exactly.
You have to, you have to use a material that would survive enough radiation, but then also allow the instruments to work.
Yes.
And provide us with enough data. So that's kind of a very complex technical thing someone has to think about, and I guess a thermal engineer is a position for that.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a production of the Centre for Planetary Science and Exploration. This episode was produced by John Kissy and Parshi Patel, and featured an interview by co-host John Kissy. Our roundtable discussion featured co-host John Kissy, and our editors were John Kissy and Parshi Patel. I'm John Kissy. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website at cpsx.uwa.ca/westernworlds. You can also visit our pages on Twitter and Facebook. On behalf of everybody here at Western Worlds, I would like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can join us again next time right here on Western Worlds. Thank you. Thank you.